I'm David Martin Davies, and coming up on The Source, being a father is much more complicated than many of us realize, even for those of us who are fathers. We are cast in a role that goes far beyond being the provider and protector of the family. And being a father means you are set up to fail. No one can protect their children from every threat, and to actually try to do so would hamper a child's development and their eventual independence. And the role of the father, as it is generally expected today, has evolved, and it has changed, and it's going to change again. One might think that the powerful all-father is the natural order of things with human creatures, but history tells us differently. Historian Augustine Sedgwick explains how this idea emerged in the first place, why it has changed over time, and whether it will endure. That's what's coming up on The Source, but first, this news.
Support for The Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
Live from the John L. Santico studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Is fatherhood a burden? Is it a puzzle? Is it a natural, joyful role that all men can easily master? Well, one thing is certain, fatherhood is loaded with expectations that are impossible to 100% satisfy. We're going to be discussing the history of fatherhood with historian Augustine Sedgwick. His book is Fatherhood, A History of Love and Power. But first, I want to play a clip from the film Fences, based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning play written by August Wilson. It focuses on the life of Troy Maxson, played by Denzel Washington here, a former Negro League baseball player turned garbage collector. It delves deep into the theme of fatherhood.
Can I ask you a question?
What the hell you got to ask me? Mr. Stewicki, the one you got the questions for.
How come you ain't never liked me?
Like you? Who the hell said I got to like you? What law is there say I got to like you? Want to stand up in front of my face and ask a damn fool-ass question like that? Talking about liking somebody. Come here, boy, when I talk to you. Straighten up, goddammit. I asked you a question. What law is there say I got to like you?
None.
All right, then. Don't you eat every day? Answer me when I talk to you. Don't you eat every day?
Yeah.
As long as you in my house, you put a sir on the end of it when you talk to me.
Yes, sir.
You eat every day.
Yes, sir.
Got a roof over your head.
Yes, sir.
Got clothes on your back.
Yes, sir.
Why you think that is?
Because of you.
Hell, I know it's because of me. But why do you think that is?
Because you like me?
Like you. I go out of here every morning. I bust my butt putting up with them crackers every day because I like you. You're about the biggest fool I ever saw. It's my job. It's my responsibility. A man is supposed to take care of his family. You live in my house, fill your belly with my food, put you behind on my bed because you're my son. Not because I like you, because it's my duty to take care of you. I owe a responsibility to you. Now, let's get this straight right here now before I go along any further. I ain't got to like you. Mr. Rand don't give me my money come payday because he like me. He give it to me because he owe me. Now, I don't give you everything I got to give you. I give you your life. Me and your mama worked that out. Between us, and liking your black ass wasn't part of the bargain. Now, don't you go through life worrying about whether somebody like you or not. You best be making sure they're doing right by you. You understand what I'm saying?
Yes, sir.
Then get the hell out of my face and get on down to that A&P.
Augustine Sedgwick, welcome to The Source. From your historical perspective, what does Denzel Washington's character get right or wrong here talking about his responsibility and fatherhood?
Thanks for having me, Dave. What an amazing clip, a great introduction. It's hard not to want to hear more Denzel at this point, to be honest with you. That clip is so suggestive of so many of the key themes of the history of fatherhood. I started researching this project in the summer of 2017, not long after my own son was born, precisely because I thought it wasn't so simple as Denzel would have made it out to be, as he was making it out to be in that clip. When we arrived at the hospital for my son to be born, Bill Cosby's mistrial was on every TV in the maternity ward, America's Dad. That fall, my first memories of being a father, and my first memories of my son and I together were I would strap him to my chest in a baby carrier, and I would walk around our neighborhood, and he would fall asleep, and I would just scroll through endless Me Too stories on my phone. And in those moments, questions were coming up that are not the ones that are addressed by even the most helpful parenting books. It was hard for me to understand what it meant to be a father in the first place and what I was supposed to be doing here at all. I felt like the old role models simply no longer applied. And I needed a new way. And so to look for it, I did the only thing I felt qualified to do, which was look to history.
What would Marcus Aurelius say about Denzel's speech?
Boy, I'm ventriloquizing one fictional character's response to another. That's a complicated question. I have a feeling he would say to the son, accept it and move on. Find your own way, which is certainly that's something that, fa that fathers and sons have said to each other across the centuries. You know, the interesting thing is that for an idea like fatherhood, which is so often used as a metaphor for history itself, you know, origins and legacy and inheritance, the history of fatherhood itself is not clear. Its own origins are uncertain. The very earliest artifacts in the human cultural record seem to emphasize motherhood. These are the goddess figurines. They're a collection of relatively small figurines that have been found across Eurasia and date to perhaps 50,000 years ago and maybe even older. But they share these the physical characteristics of large breasts and bellies and seem to emphasize female reproductive power. In contrast, there is nothing on the same time scale that would seem to represent male reproductive power. The oldest phallic imagery seems to be about on something on the order of 10,000 years old. And yet, by the time of the beginning of the written historical record, about 5,000 years ago, fatherhood is already everywhere. It's the basis for the earliest written texts and religious documents. You can already see in much of the earliest writing how men are claiming for themselves this kind of godlike power that Denzel and others have evoked. I know what's best for you. Do as I say, and if you do, you will be protected and provided for. Now, this is a theme across millennia of fatherhood, men claiming this godlike mandate. Now, the interesting thing, of course, is that humans are not gods. Mortals cannot guarantee eternal provision and protection, even when their children obey their every directive. And so, at some point, protection will fall short, provision will run out, someone is going to die, a father or a child. And that's not the fault of the individual, but the fault of the kind of institutional and cultural expectations that have been loaded into this idea of fatherhood.
And the cultural expectations today that we have in this era is that fathers provide also emotional nourishment and connection, emotional guidance. There is no law that says I have to like you. I mean, but maybe there is. Maybe fathers are expected to, I mean, they are expected to have an emotional connection and do more than just put food on the table and clothes on the back and protect the family. The role has changed. What Denzel in that role, his character was saying, may have been appropriate 2,000 years ago, but today I think it has changed. And we're going to talk about that a lot more when we come back from the break. And our phone lines are open. You can call in with your questions and comments about the expectations of fatherhood. Are we expecting too much? And is fatherhood broken? Is it in crisis today in America? Give us a call. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, and we'll be right back.
Support for TPR comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp carrier dedicated to handling claims proactively and a commitment to helping injured employees and workers' comp policyholders get back to business. TexasMutual.com/claims.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're discussing fatherhood. The book is Fatherhood, A History of Love and Power by historian Augustine Sedgwick. So is fatherhood in crisis? Men and women and boys, are they in crisis? You write that.
There seems to be a lot of evidence to suggest that there is a change happening. There is hard sociological evidence that men and boys are lagging women and girls in significant metrics, including education and professional attainment, and many all kind of also social metrics as well, including friendship, which is seems to be and falling behind in friendship and indicators of loneliness as well, which seems to be kind of wide-ranging social problem with serious consequences that I think really deserve close attention and study and ideas about how to fix them. I think that in order to understand the dimensions of that problem fully, in order to see fully what we must do to change it and find a new way forward, we have to understand where our notions of masculinity have come from in the first place. Certainly the history of fatherhood is one of the main currents of the history of masculinity more generally. For millennia, human beings have insisted and assumed that to be a man in full, you have to be a father. And the way that we have defined fatherhood has kind of set the parameters for our larger ideas of manhood, whether it's whether you're a successful man or a failure. I mean, for example, in the context of the Industrial Revolution, the shape of family life changed. Men were increasingly, for centuries previously, men had been expected to pass down to their families a resource, often tangible, a land or property or a skill or a title. The Industrial Revolution changed all of that by, in effect, taking those things away from a lot of households. Men were no longer able to own things to pass down to their families. Many of the skills they had were no longer valuable in the marketplace. Men were increasingly expected to go out and work. And it is from this transformation in the world more generally that the idea of the breadwinner comes. Bread is not something you pass down to your family. It's something you go out and get and bring it back and they eat it, or and it goes bad and then you have to go get more. This, the idea of the breadwinner as a father, is something that's still very strong, but is actually quite new. And of course, the way of talking about people as breadwinners implies another new possibility, which is thinking about men as losers. So even the very way we think about whether one individual life and one family is successful or unsuccessful has changed over time with our changing conceptions of love and power and fatherhood.
Yeah, and during that Victorian era of the Industrial Revolution, one of the big idea shapers of the time was Charles Dickens. He had a profound influence on the cultural idea of fatherhood in the 19th century. Before Dickens, fathers were depicted as stern, powerful, and emotionally detached in popular media. But Dickens' novels introduced fathers who were vulnerable, nurturing, and morally fallible.
One of the Dickens novels that really fits here is called Dombey and Son. Dombey and Son is the story of a proprietor who is desperate to pass down his enterprise down to his children. And in a world where business and the economy was changing fast, and where the endurance of a particular business, in this case Dombey's firm, was by no means guaranteed. The title was a kind of joke on Dombey. It was a kind of joke about this particular character's difficulties in establishing a stable business that could be passed on down through time to his heirs. But the funny thing is, this is such a conventional way of naming and identifying businesses now, and son. But Before the Industrial Revolution, Anne's son would have been redundant. Every business was basically Anne's son, and it was only in the context of the Industrial Revolution and the market revolution that followed quickly after it that people began that proprietors began to add Anne's son to the name of their firm in order to indicate their stability as a business, or just to give consumers some idea that they were a business that was going to be around for a long time. It was a kind of branding.
Right. That book certainly reflects Dickens' preoccupation with how fathers shape their children for better or for worse. So, when it comes to, the role of the father, we have to recognize that it is an invention. This has been created and imposed upon us.
The word imposed is a loaded word. It's probably not inappropriate in this case, but yes, absolutely, fatherhood is an invention. As I mentioned, in the earliest record of human meaning making, which dates back perhaps 50, maybe 100,000 years, there's really no indication of fatherhood. It arises instead at some point between 50 and 5,000 years ago. Where did it come from? There's no, we'll probably never know for sure. There are many theories about that. But the truth is that probably for the vast majority of our existence as a species, there was no understanding of human reproduction that could have supported anything like our contemporary conception of biological fatherhood. In other words, there was no understanding of a one-to-one relation between an act of sex and a pregnancy. Where could human beings have arrived at such an understanding? One possibility, which was suggested in the late 70s by feminist historians especially, was that that cattle breeding specifically might have been something that showed men, especially because they were usually in charge of livestock, the one-to-one relationship between sex and pregnancy. Cattle breeding, more than breeding other forms of animals, is as many Texas listeners will realize, an intensely violent enterprise, an intensely kind of vivid demonstration of male reproductive power. And feminist historians suggested that cattle breeding might have been a source of this understanding of a one-to-one relationship between sex and pregnancy and the role of the father in making new life. There's never been the same ambiguity about motherhood, and it's often been suggested that the vivid clarity of the role of mothers in making and sustaining new life was the basis for prehistoric matriarchies, societies that worshipped and maybe even were ruled by women predominantly. Again, there's no kind of confirmed evidence for such claims, but you can, they kind of make a common, sort of common sense.
So, I mean, then using that metric to decide who's a successful father who has the most children, so Genghis Khan would be the most successful father in history.
Well, that I didn't know him personally, and so haven't, who knows how
But
many,
his genes
what the
are
numbers are.
everywhere.
Right, but the oh, fair point. That certainly in the Bible, the great patriarchs are,
Abraham.
they're rich in they're said to be rich in herds and wives, and so in even in the Roman Empire, your social standing was in large part determined by the number of people who called you father. That was kind of the great patriarchs of in Rome were those with the most people who called them father, and households were managed by the oldest male, and everyone in generations below the old eldest male were referred to the patriarch as a kind of father. So the idea that quantity supersedes quality has been around for a while, for sure.
So, how did the ancient Greeks define the role of father?
Yeah, in ancient Greece, in the Greece of the classical Athens of Plato and Aristotle, there was no kind of concept of family as we have it, of kind of a group defined by biology and affiliation. There was instead the concept of the household. The household was a set of people and things, including family, biological relations of the patriarch, land, possessions, and of course also the enslaved. And each household was under the aegis of a patriarch. And within the household, the patriarch had more or less absolute power to determine who and what was in and out. In ancient Greece, a baby was born. A newborn baby was not considered a legal person until a father acknowledged it as his child. Women gave birth, but fathers created legal persons. And
that's a lot.
The house, yeah, that is an extraordinary power of the father to give or deny legal personhood. And the household was, of course, itself the model for the state. And I think that in my book, I say that in a moment of decline for ancient Athens, Plato and Aristotle found themselves or kind of they laid out the parameters of what we might consider the first debate over what it means to be a father. They both believed that fathers were to blame for the decline of Athens, but they just had radically different ideas about what to do about that, and debated among themselves in these texts that survive as the basis for the Western political tradition.
Right. Even today, when we talk about a society that's in decline, they will point to the disintegration of the so-called traditional family values. And our people will say, well, where is the father? And if that is the problem, why there is this, you know, this dissolution of societies, because the family unit is weakened because the father is not present.
Right. What history suggests to me about today's politics and today's questions about family and fatherhood is that we are in another moment where historical change, social change has created again a need to rethink the role of the fatherhood, a role of fatherhood. I mean, what I saw by looking at history was that in moments of profound historical change, for example, the Industrial Revolution, for example, a crisis in classical Athens that seemed to threaten the city itself, men responded to those problems, to those changes and crises by innovating new ideas of fatherhood that helped them hold on to disproportionate power and authority and in effect stabilize social, economic, and political life across these profound historical transformations. So I think we find ourselves in another moment of larger uncertainty, of uncertainty and change in the world that has shifted the ground underneath the existing structures of male power and authority. That is creating questions about, well, what should happen next? And I think it's very predictable from history that we would have some people saying we need to go back to a traditional model, and other people strongly saying the opposite, that we need to forge ahead with a more equal, open, flexible model.
Right, traditional family is what? Because you tell us in your historical view that the traditional family has gone through many, many changes through history. And which one is the one that, you know, we have that logical fallacy of the wisdom of the ancients. So, you know, that doesn't necessarily mean it's the right one.
Right. I think that many of our notions of history are, of course, meant to serve our own interest in the present and to seek authority by making reference to one tradition or a single golden age that needs to be restored is something, frankly, that leaders have done for as long as there have been leaders. You know, the first Roman Emperor Augustus Caesar did the same thing when he was claiming power. Claiming an imperial power over Rome and its colonial satellites, he insisted that Rome had been great when families were stronger and fathers were in charge, and therefore he was going to reform morality across the Roman Empire and restore this age of Roman
And he would
greatness.
Be the father of fathers. We're going to take a break here. We're going to continue our conversation talking about fatherhood, a history of love and power. You can call in. The number is 833-877-8255. Peter, I'm going to get you on the air. When we come back, this is The Source. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Fatherhood, a History of Love and Power. It's a new book by historian Augustine Sedgwick. And you can call in with your questions and comments, 833-877-8255. And Peter, hi, Peter. Thanks for calling in. You're on the air.
Thank you for having me on. I appreciate it. I have a question. So having been raised by a stepfather, so I wasn't his biological son, and a very strong mother, there was conflict since my mother remarried, and she, before that, had taken on the role of the father and the mother. So the father figure that was in the picture, looking back at it now, never really had the opportunity to actually be a true father, though he tried his best very hard. But I was wondering if you see that conflict a lot in fatherly figures nowadays, where there are more fathers that remarry and then have to take on children from, you know, their new spouse.
Interesting.
It's curious.
Interesting, Peter. So, Augustus, how does the role of the substitute father, the stepfather, being able to be someone who can provide fatherhood?
Well, that's a great question, because it really does demonstrate how we have expectations for a predetermined set of roles. The idea that one man can step in and take on the father role in a context that preexisted him and his involvement is really does clearly define the parameters of our expectations in this case. And what's interesting here is that it wasn't only, I started this book not only in order to understand my relationship with my son, but also to understand my relationship with my father. Not long before my son was born, my father had a stroke that really changed his personality, and our family changed around that. So in a way, he became a person who was different from the father I grew up with. I wanted to understand something about that through this fatherhood research. And I think, looking back in the past did not help me find a model for an ideal father. It made me resist the idea that there is one model. It made me, in a way, appreciate who my father had been then and now on his own terms. The idea that fatherhood has changed over time should ideally open us up to the possibility of a more flexible, more generous, more humane, more open-hearted set of ideas about who men are and should be, in a way that helps us meet each other on our own terms, ideally. Easier said than done, of course, but stepfathering, step-parenting, I think is a good example of how that can work.
Yeah, so let's drill down on the expectations problem. The expectations for the ideal father are off the, they're off the meter. They're so high, impossible to meet. So you should just accept that every father, despite his best intentions, despite everything that he's done, is still always going to fall short.
Well, I think men bear most of the responsibility for the high expectations that have been loaded into the idea of fatherhood. I think as from the very beginning of the written historical record, fatherhood is defined as a kind of godlike mandate to protect and provide. As we discussed briefly, for human beings who are not gods but mortals, these expectations are not possible to fulfill always. Someone at some point is going to die, protection is going to fall short, provision is going to run out, and that is not the fault of individual men. Instead, it's the fault of the expectations that have been loaded into this institution. I think it's probable that men have made these extraordinary, even impossible promises in order to elevate themselves above women, whose role in the creation and sustenance of life was unmistakably clear from the beginning. So how could men compete with that? Only by making these extraordinary, impossible, godlike promises. These are always bound to fall. We are always bound to fall short of those promises. So maybe it's time to think about opening up to another approach to caring for the people that we love and who depend on us.
So you talk about the father being the provider and the protector, but what about the punisher, the godlike father bringing the flood, the apocalypse, in order to punish?
Yeah, when it's deserved, I will punish. When it's deserved, I will reward. When it's deserved, you know, I will provide and protect.
And that's contradictory towards protector.
Not necessarily. It's a way of knowing what it's the paternal mandate is. I know what's best for you. Do as I say, and if you follow my instructions, you'll be protected. And if you don't, you'll suffer.
A boy named Sue, you know, the father of the Johnny Cash song, names the child Sue. So he grows up to be tough and is able to handle the world. But, you know, but by subjecting his child to constant torment.
Ralph Waldo Emerson, who lived during the early phases of the Industrial and Market Revolution, thought that the ideal parenting was kind of being raised by wolves, like Romulus, who founded Rome. He went not long after the birth of his own son. He wrote a poem that he ended up using as an epigram for his essay, Self-Reliance. It said, the first lines of the poem are, "Cast the bantling on the rocks." I had to look it up, but bantling means baby, infant. And for Emerson, you would throw the child to the wolves and he would survive by learning the laws of nature. Or not at all. And that was the best kind of parenting.
So the father of, of Judaism, Abraham, was instructed to take his child to the mountain and sacrifice him as the test. And so when we read that in our modern viewpoint from our modern eyes and understand that story, is like, how could he do that? What an incredible, horrible thing to ask of somebody. And of course, are we reading too much into the fact that God instructed Abraham to sacrifice his only son?
And Abraham said, "God, where do you want this killing done?" And then God said, "Out on Highway 61." So for Bob Dylan, who's another one of the fathers I write about in my book, And also for Freud, who preceded Dylan in the kind of history of fatherhood and in the chapters of my book, the idea that men were kind of not only protectors and providers of their sons, but also godlike figures with the power to punish and kill and fight and battle with was actually a good thing. Like Emerson, Freud and Dylan thought that children developed into full grown people, fully mature men through the conflicts with their parents and especially with their fathers. Freud's ideas can be reduced to the edict to kill your father. Dylan kind of embodied that for a generation, even as he himself sought to be a traditional father or the man at home. So, yeah, these things are not so much contradictory as they are part of the kind of weight of expectation that is built into the role of fatherhood. I mean, we have a shared idea, a cultural norm of fatherhood that asks fathers to be both, to be providers, protectors, and willing to be bested and defeated and vanquished by their sons and daughters who will grow up to be adults only when they, as Freud said, kill the father.
It's How did the Protestant Reformation change the family structure and the father's authority?
This was another kind of moment of historical transformation in which men have to develop a new idea of fatherhood that sustains and supports their father their authority, power and authority over time. I mean, Henry VIII was really desperate. We know he was desperate for a male heir because he thought that without a son who could he could cede his throne to, or he could pass his throne to, his regime would not survive. What we don't really know is that Henry VIII actually had a son the whole time, even before he wanted to get married to Anne Boleyn and try again. He had an illegitimate son who he was considering making king. In order to do so, of course, Henry would have had to change the rules, not only the church rules of marriage and family, but also the rules of inheritance. And he set about trying to do so, and he got help from an unexpected source, especially Martin Luther, who argued that fathers, not priests, were fathers in the home rather than fathers in the church were the correct interpreters of God's word. And Henry VIII, combined with Martin, the sanction of Martin Luther, really expanded the power of fathers in the context of the Reformation to determine which of their children would get the benefits of inheritance, get the benefits of legacy. The power of the father expanded to include the power now to decide who was going to inherit what. And who was not going to get anything at all, which you can understand is quite a power
Quite a
around the
card to
household.
play in a self-reinforcing idea. You say, well, fathers are the most powerful ones. And of course, all the fathers are going to say, yeah, that sounds pretty good to me. Let's do that. So we're going to take another break here. I want to talk about Thomas Jefferson. Why does Thomas Jefferson decide to have a star on the Fatherhood Walk of Fame, at least according to our author today, author of Fatherhood, A History of Love and Power, Augustine Sedgwick. And you can call in with your questions and comments, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. The Source continues right after this. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're joined by Augustine Sedgwick. He is the author. He's a historian. His book is Fatherhood, A History of Love and Power. Thomas Jefferson, one of our founding fathers, you write about him in the book. People know him not as a terrific father because his children were enslaved.
Right. Jefferson and his colleagues in the revolutionary generation didn't really think of themselves as founding fathers. They thought of themselves as founding brothers. They thought of themselves as members of the same generation. And historians have long understood the American Revolution and the creation of the United States as a kind of generational conflict. The King of England had assumed the kind of extraordinary powers of the fathers that Henry VIII had in part established, the kind of this absolute power to say who got what and when and who didn't get anything at all and would just have to like it. That was an idea that was contested at the time, especially during the Enlightenment, by John Locke, among others. John Locke, interestingly enough, had no children of his own, but he was considered an authority on fatherhood, in part because of his experience as a doctor and his experience as a political advisor. And these two sets of skills made John Locke's friends think that he knew everything there was to know about raising children. And Locke kind of advised his friends on how to raise their children in a way that informed his political philosophy. Locke thought that the job of a father was not to have an absolute power over his children, but to prepare his children for their own maturation, to teach his children how to be on their own and to allow them to be on their own when the time came. You can understand this appeal for people like Jefferson, who thought that the colonies had matured to the point where they deserved to be on their own, not subject to the whims and priorities of the King of England. And Jefferson and his colleagues thought of himself as killing the father, and who had not been treating them well, and therefore deserved deserve to be vanquished.
Right, and they John Locke also introduced the idea or popularized the idea of the consent of the governed and the social contract of government.
Right. The model for this was a kind of father's power over his children. And when the children didn't need it, the father anymore, they could decide to rule themselves. That was what it meant to grow up, in effect.
Yeah, and so Thomas Jefferson, you know, he took this to heart. He wrote the documents that created the United States, or had a big hand in it. So, and here we are, though. How is he applying this to his actual family? He is Sally Hemings.
Well, right. Jefferson is claiming, on the one hand, the right to refuse the power of the father, the King of England, the right to claim for him, the power of the father for himself. But he is, at the same time as he is rejecting the absolute authority of the King of England, his misbehaving father, Jefferson and the members of the revolutionary generation are claiming for themselves kind of sweeping and indefinite paternal powers over indigenous Americans and over enslaved Black Americans. Jefferson especially used the power of the fathers to govern indigenous Americans, to kind of tell them how to live if they ever were to fit into quote unquote white society. And of course, he was governing his own plantations as a kind of patriarch who owned and had power over all of the components of his household, land, material possessions, including and enslaved human beings. And Jefferson exercised a kind of absolute power of the father over his children. Father and master. He determined what kind of jobs they would do. He determined who would take care of them.
They could have been born legally white if he had acknowledged them, but he didn't. So they didn't have to be born into enslavement, even though their mother was Sally Hemings. Is that correct?
Right. Well, Jefferson's children were born legally white because there was a rule in Virginia that determined race by the number of crosses between white and Black parents. So Jefferson's parents were born legally white, but that alone was not enough to, quote unquote, to make them free white persons. Because they were born to an enslaved mother, they themselves were enslaved and therefore had to be given their freedom by their owner, who was also their father, Thomas Jefferson, which he did, but only after he died. And interestingly enough, one of his children told the story of their family into a small newspaper in Ohio well after the death of his father, in ways that were really kind of profound, in ways that his father, Thomas Jefferson, never did in his own life. And that was one of my favorite anecdotes to discover in the course of writing this book.
So not Father of the Year.
Father of the Year, not Father of the Year. But, you know, I mean, as I say this as a father of myself, who is Father of the Year? The best thing I think I realized that I could do for my child was to stop insisting on my power to say what he needed to do, when and how, and listen instead to what he was asking me for. You know, I got to the end of this historical research and I didn't find a lot of models in the past that I wanted to adopt in my own life. And for a while, I felt kind of frustrated about that. I felt like I hadn't answered my own questions in this book. And then one afternoon, I thought for the first time to ask my child, who was 6 at the time, what he thought it meant to be a father. Without missing a beat, he answered that a father should be funny and good at hugging. And so that's what I'm working on at the moment.
Okay. Well, so we have a post-World War II, what a father is, the invention of fatherhood continues. And this is through popular media, television especially, you know, whether it's Father Knows Best or the Andy Griffith Show or what have you, constantly trying to create a father who is funny and good at hugging and can solve problems within 30 minutes, you know, sitting in the easy chair, reading the newspaper and telling my three sons, you know, how to shape their lives.
Well, I don't remember there being a lot of hugging on those shows, to be honest with you. I think that's kind of even a more modern invention. The truth is that after World War II and in the context of the Cold War, the kind of Freudian conflict between fathers and children didn't seem all that ideal. Part of the promise of American capitalism and Western capitalism was a prosperous, happy life. And it wasn't part of the suburban ideal that kids would want to kill off their father or vice versa. So the figure of the dad was really a post-war invention that was meant to soften domestic relations, to ease domestic relations, to make sure everyone just had a good time at home, playing in the yard and at Little League and on weekends, and whatever. And so this becomes the idea that the father has to joke and play with kids kind of becomes another thing that's added to the men's plates.
But that's part of the Cold War, you know, dance that we're doing, trying to, we're constantly comparing ourselves to the Soviet Union. And this is, you know, showing that America is strong and family unit is strong. And although it is absolutely a invention and doesn't really match what most people experience.
Yeah, we're supposed to show that life is good, right, under American capitalism. And so therefore, a father has not only has to work all day and be a breadwinner, but then come home and have fun too. And as any parent knows, that can be a lot to ask. But it was a creation not of people who were experiencing it, but of people who wanted to promote a particular ideal. And these ideals become expectations and realities.
Right. So it's important to recognize that the idea of fatherhood has changed and has been shaped by political necessities, and it is continuing to change. And we're just going to have to sit back and wait to see what we're going to end up with and find out on the fly if it works.
No, we're not going to do that. Instead, we're going to listen to what the people we love are asking us to do and be. We're going to step back from the mandate to always be telling them that we know best and we know what they should be doing and how. And instead, we're going to listen to what and who they are asking us to do and be.
And be present, be available, provide, protect, all those things.
I think of it, the word that means a lot to me at the moment is to accompany, to learn as well as teach, to listen as well as instruct and tell, and to to accompany through this profound and truly transformative experience of loving someone and being loved.
All right. And we'll know when we get there. This is necessary because the model we have now is in crisis.
It's because the most powerful thing you can do is love someone and be loved. And if we were to open ourselves to the full dimensions of that, I think we would be more generous with ourselves and each other. And by we, I do specifically mean men.
All right. Well, Sedgwick, thank you so much. Augustus, thank you so much for joining us today. We appreciate it. Fatherhood, a history of love and power, a lot to think about, a lot to talk about, especially when you gather for Father's Day. Appreciate the talk.
Thank you so much for having me. It's my pleasure.
That's The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Thanks for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies. Tim Gutierrez is the show's producer. Additional production support from Steve Short, Ruben Garcia, Yvette Benavides, and Dan Katz. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.